Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And in our appeals to heaven, asking for his providence as well as his blessings in allowing us to restore our constitutional republic, we need to continue to learn, pray, act. And as I always say, the whole movement, what we need to be doing, because I truly believe that this is where the blessing will come. If we're trying to aggrandize our station in life, in other words, make money, get, you know, make our situation better for some financial purpose, or I should say for some temporal, carnal, what have you type of purposes, then I don't believe that we're going to receive the blessings we need. But if we're focused on full compliance, because I believe those who obviate and try to get you to focus on one particular issue, they're not accepting the Constitution in its entirety. Or what they're trying to do is they're trying to convince to you that the rest of the Constitution is worthless, or that the only thing that matters is what they're trying to get you to focus on and getting you to turn your back on the rest of the Constitution. And as far as I see that as our biggest problems. This is why when I look at the conservative camp and I look at all of these myopic organizations out there, it is the problem. Our greatest problem is ourselves. We're allowing ourselves to become distracted from what the real solution is, uniting on full compliance to the Constitution. And I think I couldn't say it any better than that. So at that point, let me just reintroduce you to Sean. And Sean, welcome back. And anything to add?
Well, it's great to be with you, GR.
Okay, thank you.
Ready to get into it.
Yeah,
get
you know,
back where we started from.
I really appreciate you stepping up and doing this, and your contributions, just like Tammy, are just really welcomed. Having discussions is far better than monologues. I feel like I'm always preaching, and in a way, I know I am. And in a way, I know I'm a hard-nosed guy. I mean, a lot of people just don't like that. And I think that that's what we're supposed to be. I don't think we're supposed to be accepting of compromise. And, you know, people look and go, you know, it's just because people have a conservative view doesn't mean they're wrong. You know, if they're looking more on the religious slant, that doesn't mean that they're wrong. And so I'm going to just digress real quick. It was brought up, and there's an example that is using, I believe, the Ten Commandments of Alabama. Remember, there was a conversation about that this week, right?
I did not hear anything about it.
Oh, okay. So that's okay. There was a conversation this week that it was brought up as an interposition in contrast to, you know, the Caesar of Rome looking to put his statue in the temple, and how Israel stood up and said, we will kill you if you try to do that. And so it didn't get done, and that was a level of interposition and commitment that they had, you know, in their theocracy, or I should say in their faith. And so in the interposition, because there was, you know, the state was trying to step in because they had on display the Ten Commandments in Alabama, in the court. And the federal government came in and said, thou shalt get rid of those things. Now, first off, the claim is that that was an establishment clause, that was violating the Constitution, that no state shall, you know, establish a religion. Well, actually, that's not the U.S. Constitution's claim that no state shall do that. What it states in the Constitution, in the 14th Amendment, because you've got to remember, folks, the Bill of Rights applies to the federal government only, that the, only the federal government couldn't establish a church. Why? Because 8 of the states already had established churches. So if that was truly the intent of the First Amendment, then why didn't the federal government, as soon as the Bill of Rights was ratified, why didn't the federal government start burning down churches and saying, how dare you establish a church? As a matter of fact, states were joining the union, such as Kentucky, Tennessee, and so forth, and having state-sponsored churches. Vermont was one of them. Vermont was a state that joined the churches along with Tennessee and so forth. And they were establishing it. And this is one of the reasons why I mentioned that had we allowed the Articles of Confederation to move forward and how the Northwest Territory would have expanded along with Tennessee and Kentucky, I see that the Anglican Church would have became the dominant church under the Articles of Confederation, and the Articles of Confederation would have created by popular or by democracy, because that's kind of how it was. More states would say, we want an Anglican church to be established as the church of the land. And it would have basically laid or paved the way for the turmoil and destruction and death in the name of religion in America. And the framers recognized that. And that was one of the reasons why Madison really, really focused on that very particular issue, that the federal government could not choose a religion. So back to the Alabama case. As Alabama was looking at it, they were basically saying, hey, and they were actually wrong in how they were trying to go after the federal government. Because the federal government said that thou shalt not establish a religion. And they didn't clearly delineate how, and they didn't go down this path of how the states actually weren't held to that. The 14th Amendment clearly states that no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. And so having the Ten Commandments in the court, how is it that a person's privileges and immunities, a U.S. citizen in or visiting the state of Alabama, what privileges and immunities were being abridged because of that?
Free expression.
But so no, they could still express. They could say, I find that abhorrent. The state has chosen to use that as an expression. The people of the state. The people of the state have actually continued to support the fact that the Ten Commandments were in their court. So technically, it's not that the state had created any law and enforced a law that said you can't freely exercise your religion, you can't speak out against it, or you can't actually, you know, have create your own. But we, the people of the state of Alabama, have foreordained that that monument on the Ten Commandments be there and it be representative of we, the people of Alabama. Now, once Alabama crosses that threshold, when they actually, on their own, through an amendment in their own constitution, say, we will no longer promote at the state level any faith, then that would be different. Does that make sense?
Right. So it's about establishing a church.
Correct. And a state can actually establish a church. If the people
right.
the of that
state. Government can.
There you go. And as long as that state doesn't deny its citizens, the citizens of the United States and of that state, or any citizen visiting that state, deny them their right to freely express their religious, you know, perspectives and worshiping and so forth, then they can actually do that. And I state this in the most sincere way. Churches are the reason why America became great. There's no doubt. The different faiths, the different churches throughout the states, they performed a function that the government should not perform. And as a matter of fact, we read about this in the cod fishery bounties on Monday, or Tuesday, I mean. Remember that?
And Madison was actually using for shock value this shock. He was saying, if we allow money to be the gauge of the power of our government, then we will take over education, we will take over religion, and all these other things. Because he says, then because by the spending and the collection of money and the spending thereof, we can assume power over everything under the sun, instead of being limited to the enumerated powers in the Constitution. This, by actually what he says, actually goes and completely decimates this concept of having a balanced budget amendment. Because a balanced budget amendment basically says the federal government can spend this much money on whatever they want to, as long as it does not exceed this much of the GDP. Do you understand how disastrous that would be? Because now they could actually spend money on anything they want. Currently, with the enumerations, they cannot spend money on education. They cannot spend money on environment, energy, housing, labor, on and on and on and on. The Department of Transportation. The fact is that they're doing it in violation of the Constitution, which is what the states need to step up and say, stop it. You have no authority. This debt you're raising is all unconstitutional. This is fraud. You're perpetrating fraud upon us, and you're working with these international states who are basically buying this debt with these fraudulent intents to capitulate America. So I'm hoping I kind of went the full circle here to really kind of prove that when we look at the argument must be based on the constitutions. And remember, it was Madison in the report on the Virginia resolutions where he very succinctly came right out and said, and I believe this was like in the very last part of the 26th paragraph, the second to last paragraph of the report on the Virginia resolutions. He says, the authority is actually, he starts off with this basically important thing that we need to have recurrence here made to those principles ought to be viewed as unseasonable and improper or as vigilant discharge of an important duty. The authority of constitutions over governments and the sovereignty of the people over constitutions are truths which are at all times necessary to be kept in mind, and at no time perhaps more necessary than at the present. Now, if we go back to 2006 or whenever the Ten Commandments were ripped out of Alabama, everybody completely they did not understand, they forgot this concept, that the authority of constitution, which their constitution probably had granted them, you know, for the church to do what they, because it was an early state that joined the Union. If I remember correctly, it joined this Union before Missouri. And as we look at this concept of what they had in their constitution, they granted that power. There's no doubt in my mind that the state would have this relationship with their church. And it was probably Anglican. And as we look at what power that those people gave to that state to do, the federal government had no business getting itself involved in violating the rights of the people to establish their government, because that is even that's the bedrock of our republic, that we the people institute our government. Now, there's other states and people that may not like it, and people living in that state that don't like it. Well, as long as it's not infringing upon their privileges and immunities, which it wasn't, if that makes sense. They were just offended that they existed. And this goes back to some other private conversations we've had. We live in a world where people, because of their offense, because they are so offended that we exist, they believe their ends justify their means. They believe that they can kill us and should kill us because of the offense that we're causing to them. And this is just, anyway.
The assumed offense in most cases.
Well, so I believe that when you really look at it, that's how they constantly go out and they, these people are fascists. These people are evil. They're Nazis. They try to create these misdirections and mislabelings. It's called label lynching. And that's what they're doing. The left, and actually, if you really look at what's happening currently today because of the assassination of Charlie Kirk, everybody is getting caught up in the label lynching and going after people, right?
On both sides.
On both sides. I abhor racism. I abhor, the ideologies behind, these extreme fascist or these extreme autocratic paradigms. I abhor them. But I believe that if we educate ourselves, and that's the problem, we're not educated. We don't know how to actually look at somebody's opinion and recognize that it's an opinion or recognize it's a view. And as a matter of fact, we actually need to get better educated to identify ideas and views that are contrary and actually seditious as well as dangerous to our constitutional republic. See, if you really want to get rid of some of these bad paradigms, anybody that is exercising an insurrection against the Constitution is committing treason. Now, because we haven't covered this yet, but I want to just throw this out here before we get into Section 6 of Article 1. In 1792, there was a whiskey tax or distilled liquors tax that was passed by the federal government to tax the states with a excise tax so that they could raise money. Now, that was all legitimate. It was all constitutional because it was deemed uniform, because all the states per capita pretty much consumed the same amount of distilled liquor. And so one of the things, and I think I was going to mention this, but I didn't, Hamilton originally tried to put a excise tax or a sales tax on horses, that when the transaction of a horse sale went through, that the government would be able to make money off of those. And it was proven that the population of horses and transactions were so disparately unequal that the South had so many horses, the North hardly any, and the transactions would have just been marginal by the northern states, and the southern states would be basically paying that tax. Therefore, it was shot down because it would not have been uniform, could not be uniformly applied.
You said that was Hamilton?
Hamilton, correct. Again, yeah.
That guy.
He was always pushing every envelope and trying to create burdens. But the whiskey tax, because he created this debt, he had to start creating these taxes. So he created the whiskey tax. And, there's a lot of people that love Hamilton, but they all kind of say, oh, that was a bad tax. And everybody acknowledges it was a bad tax. Regardless, it was within the purview and the authority, the delegated power of the federal government to do. And so when the whiskey tax went out, there was a huge rebellion in western Pennsylvania. And that rebellion continued. And there was property damage, and there were some scuffles that got out of hand, and I think one or two people got killed. I think those people ended up being arrested for murder or for the charges of killing somebody. But what ended up happening, because it kept on going, and this, I'll say these protestors who were protesting the whiskey tax were being more and more enabled, and they would go into towns, or they would start, and I believe they ended up ultimately going into Pittsburgh. This large body of protesters, and you know what the city of Pittsburgh ended up doing? They ended up throwing, putting these big casks of whiskey out to basically let the crowd, these guys get completely in a stupor drunk, so that it would just basically make him unable to do anything or incapacitated. And so I think it was shortly after that when the militia shows up and arrests 24 of the men who were deemed as the leaders and the agitators of the whiskey rebellion. These 24 men were charged with treason, taken back to the District of Columbia, and charged treason. Two were convicted. Now, that's not speaking out and actually creating laws and creating things in government that are absolutely contrary and destructive. you know, supporting the invasion, supporting the, you know, the importation of persons unconstitutionally through treaties. All of these things that we have First Amendment petitions are equally and even more treasonous than the Whiskey Rebellion.
Absolutely.
And so my point is that when we really put perspective to these ideologies, because they've been so enabled that they're actually executing their insurrection before our very eyes. They're laying taxes on carbon credits. In Washington State, there's like 40 cents just kicked in to start capturing carbon in these taxes. That's all unconstitutional. And so my point is that we have, you know, this insurrection, this literally this treasonous, you know, layer that is embedded in our government and around our government and supporting by the people. These people need to be rounded up. They need to be stripped of their citizenship. All of their assets need to be taken from them, just like we did with the Tory Acts. And we need to deport them to a government that aligns with their practices and paradigms. In other words, we ship them to China. We ship them to Cuba or Venezuela. We don't ship them to Russia because Russia's even not that bad. Russia doesn't allow that kind of crap. So they used to, but not anymore because they're not hardcore communists like these people are. Communism and Islam are two incompatible paradigms and practices that are occurring in the United States that are vehemently violations of the Constitution. So, anyway, and that's why we go through the Constitution so people can learn and understand, so they can actually see these things for themselves and go, oh my gosh, wow, that's so unconstitutional. Okay, so we already covered this, and I don't want to belabor the point, but it kind of sets up what Section 6 is in the Constitution. And we got about 2 minutes. So this is basically the compensation of what they're given and some protections. And we kind of amplified this, you know, how this is kind of enabling them in a bad way, but it doesn't give them the ability to just grant themselves everything under the sun like they've been doing. And so let's go ahead and just read this first paragraph, and then we'll probably be ready to go into break and come back and hit the second one. Go ahead.
Section 6. The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. They shall, in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same, and for any speech or debate in either house. They shall not be questioned in any other place.
Okay, so what that means is they're definitely protected unless, and this is what I pointed out, if they commit a felony or breach of the peace, they can actually be detained and taken. But it's almost like nobody really reads this. They've just got everybody to believe that they're above the law. And oh, guess what? This same line exists in almost every state constitution where your state legislatures have protected them equally. Technically, when you read the state constitution, the federal constitution, this is only granted for our legislators. Why is it not granted for the judges and the courts? Huh. But they seem to be even more protected, don't they?
Absolutely.
But it's actually in black and white. In the language of the Constitution, they're the only ones protected. Even the president is not protected. Right. Okay. All right. So anything else? And actually, I know you've got some points you want to bring up, and I think you were bringing some stuff up when we were leaving. So when we come back from break, let's dive into those questions to where we were at this juncture and this point. And so is that fair enough?
Fair enough.
All right, great. So we're just seconds away from the music kicking in like this, and all of a sudden we're going into a break, folks. So when we come back, we'll kind of dive into some questions that Sean has that kind of came out of what we've been reading, as long with kind of maybe some current events. And then we'll dive into the second paragraph, and then we're going to dive into Section 7. Now, the real bread and butter regarding the Constitution is Section 8. We may not get to it today. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so like I said, when we were just about to go into break, and we'll bring Sean back right now because I think Sean has some questions as well as maybe some comments regarding what we were reading, but we really ran out of time. If everybody remembers yesterday, the music started kicking in and I go, oh, shoot. So we're now going to dive into what we were should have dove into yesterday. Go ahead. Go ahead, Sean. Question.
Yeah, the question was, has anyone ever been removed by a state legislature using the 14th Amendment? And what is the required process for states to accomplish that?
So I believe the only people who have been removed for failing to support the Constitution have been federal employees, because it was something that was amplified, but the teeth were not tied. This is something that I believe during Hoover and during J. Edgar Hoover, not just, president, but J. Edgar Hoover, I think, instituted laws. Now, you got to remember the FBI is an enforcement agency that is unconstitutional. The only enforcement agency the federal government has been granted under the Constitution is the militia. The line that says Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union has never been changed. There's never been anything ever superseded to, other than when you read the Constitution and you actually get into these later amendments after the Bill of Rights. Like if you look at the 14th Amendment, I believe the 14th Amendment has this little line, the Section 5, that says, the Congress shall have power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. In other words, that means that they can create law. That doesn't mean that they can create an enforcement agency. The enforcement agency was already created in the Constitution to be the militia. Does that make sense?
Right.
Okay,
yes.
So to answer your question, I don't believe that there's ever been a public example where they said, we're using Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to remove a person because they violated their oath in failing to support the Constitution or giving aid and comfort to the enemy thereof. Never. Never. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that kind of was occurring is that the radical Republicans basically laid out, and the reason I called them radical, I think I mentioned that last time, right? They were called radical Republicans because that's what that's what the progressives and the Democrats way back then called them. And that name stuck for the revisionist of history. And so today everybody refers to that class of Republicans that came together at the end of the Civil War when the Constitution had been completely set aside. So how was it set aside? I'm not sure if you knew this, but Lincoln dismissed Congress. He didn't have the power to do that. He declared martial law. He didn't have the power to do that either. And so he actually exceeded his powers. Nobody wanted to basically call him out because he was at a point where he had enough of a following that he was very threatening. And even Chief Justice Taney, who came up to him and says, "You're violating the Constitution." And he basically, I don't know if he poked him in the chest, but I can just see him doing that as a very tall man towering over Taney. He said, you know, poke him in the chest and say, "I'd like to see you enforce that." Because that's what he told him. Because he knew that he had the power of the gun with this little army that he was creating. All unconstitutional. See, we've covered this in a lot of details that you've missed in the ratification debates. That when the Constitution, when we get into Section 8, we'll dive into this. But when the Constitution says that Congress shall have the power to create or maintain and or, well, let me just read it here because it talks about establishing, to raise and support armies. That's the line right there. But the process of raising a federal army is calling forth the militia to do these things. They can't create an army just because they want one. This is why the following 14 says to provide for calling forth the militia. And the purpose for it is to execute the law, suppress insurrections, or repel invasions. They have no other purpose for calling forth the army. This is the only way they can get the states to actually surrender their militia for these three purposes. And because the states actually, they had the power to call them forth, but if they didn't have the right reason, the states could say, "You can't call them forth for that. We only delegated these three reasons." They had no ability to create an army on their own. The militia was the integral home defense system, period. It's what won the Revolutionary War, because the forces were coming from the states. They didn't have the authority to just go out and start hiring mercenaries like Britain did in hiring the Hessians, the Germans, and others to basically come to America and fight us. And so I'm hoping this answers your question, that when it comes down to this enforcement and the fact that there is, you know, this agency, the FBI, started going down the path of saying, if you're not supporting the Constitution, we'll remove you. That was going after people who were working within the government, you know, whether they be the intelligence or any of the bureaucracies. If you were doing things that were not in support of the Constitution, and it was actually regarding your, you know, your sexual behavior, personal behavior, those types of things as well. If you gambled or was drinking excessively, they had these, I think, personal behavior clauses that said, you know, you could lose your employment if you were a gambler, if you excessively drank, because they didn't think they could trust you because you had lower morals. This is when the moral standards were higher. Security clearances were definitely never given to people that were drinkers, gamblers, or people that had, you know, I'll just say, open, you know, open sex, what have you. And today, it doesn't matter. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I looked up real quick some information on the 14th Amendment removals,
yeah.
And I have one person, Victor L. Berger, in 1920, who was convicted under the Espionage Act, and they didn't want to, he was barred from taking his seat, but then he went to the Supreme Court, and they overturned it, and he ended up serving.
Okay. So,
and then we had Coy Griffin,
okay,
recently in 2022, who was a New Mexico County Commissioner who was removed from office because of January 6th.
Uh-huh.
And they tried to disqualify Trump from the Colorado ballot for January 6th using the 14th Amendment, but they were not successful.
Okay. And so... I can see. Somehow we're getting a little bit of, and as this happens every once in a while with the meeting we've got, I don't know if you can hear the echo, but this was a complete misinterpretation of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, because they were actually using a tribunal to do this. And in other words, what they were doing was they were using investigative powers. And here's the question. January 6th went after whom? Citizens protesting. Yeah. And so what they were, so they weren't really applying Section 3. They tried to start applying that to the public servants down the road. And as a matter of fact, if you remember correctly, there was another attempt to impeach Trump at about the same time, because they tried to impeach Trump during his presidency, and then they tried to impeach him again. And I believe that both times they couldn't come to an indictment for impeachment. So in other words, they held the House held an investigation to determine. So they initiated the impeachment process. So this kind of goes down with Bill Clinton in history, right? But it doesn't. So Bill Clinton was
actually had a trial, and there was evidence of what he did.
Yes, it went much further with him.
In the Trump one for insurrection, supposedly, it was just a bunch of Democrats said he did something and said, we're going to impeach him. And then it couldn't go anywhere because they had no evidence.
Right. Well, so correct. And actually, it wasn't just they had no evidence. The body of Congress or the House of Representatives voted against charging him for impeachment. So in other words, that first stage of the impeachment process failed with Trump both times. But the first phase of the impeachment with Clinton, he was truly impeached because he was charged and he was not found guilty.
Wasn't it by one vote, I think?
I don't remember, but I know it was all political. And and actually the purpose for his impeachment was all political as well. As a matter of fact, on my website, on my Red State Talk Radio podcast page, at the very bottom of my page, I have the congressional record that actually Congress received by Curry and Winterm, I believe were the names, and it's testimony to Congress on the Bill Clinton timeline of corruption. And these guys provide a timeline of the money Clinton was receiving in his first presidency going, you know, into his reelection from China. This money was going into his campaign. All illegal, and all of these things he was doing, they basically proved that, as you know, the hard drives from Los Alamos, New Mexico, were, you know, actually got into the hands of the Chinese, and everybody goes, oh my gosh, what just happened? Bill Clinton received a payment. So when you go through this, it starts on page 13, folks, if you want to go look at this. But he should have been impeached on those charges, not on the charges that he lied to Congress. Let me ask you this. Is there anywhere in the Constitution that says it is a crime to lie to Congress?
I have never seen it.
Nah, it's not there.
Exactly.
So it's one thing to perjure yourself and to say you've committed perjury to, you know, in a court or what have you. But it's another thing to say you cannot lie to Congress. You cannot lie to the FBI when we're investigating you. In other words, when are you perjuring? When does the law perjury kick in?
In court?
Yes, when you're in court or when you're under oath. Correct, when you're under oath. And so Congress has basically said, well, if you lie, then that's a crime. And then they they've amplified it far more than just a perjury. Because you do go into Congress and they investigate you. But here's the problem. The congressional investigation is limited to what?
Removal from office.
Those things that they have authority under the Constitution. So let me ask you this. If Congress is investigating steroids in professional sports, is that in the Constitution? No. So if they call you forth, put you under testimony, and make you testify, and force you to testify, you know, the only thing you need to say is you have no jurisdiction. This is not enumerated in the Constitution. Where do you get the authority to even convene and waste the taxpayers' money in an investigation like this?
I've always wondered about that because they've done this countless times, especially it's like it just exponentially becomes more.
Yes.
I'm so tired of hearing James Comer talk about they're investigating this and they're investigating that, and nothing ever comes of it because
right.
you have no authority
right.
or purview
right.
to do anything about it.
Right. Okay. So I just want to make sure because I go down these rat holes to answer questions, and I try not to, but I hopefully this is very clear. Now, there are plenty of points that we bring into I'll call them our First Amendment petitions because these all come up. These issues all come up. And we use these certain citations very, very specifically throughout these petitions. And I try to expand them through the different states. But Madison said this: the powers of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. So, in other words, professional sports not being listed, they have no jurisdiction on professional sports. So when they use executive power, or I should say not executive, investigative powers, because Congress has clearly given it, they cannot use it for something that's not enumerated. It's the same thing of trying to create a treaty with these environmental acts like the Paris Accords. They have no authority in the Constitution to be involved in environmental acts and the climate and so forth. And they're going around signing all these treaties, at least when we have leftist presidents, and these things stick. But they're all unconstitutional because they have no authority to do these things. It's
World
that
Health
simple.
Organization.
Right. So when people start realizing the limitations on the power of our government, remember that goes back to what I just said. Right? Constitutions are basically the authority for government. Government cannot act if it's not delegated to them. And the power of the sovereignty of the people over constitutions is something we all need to remember. So anyway, I could go on and on and on, but was there something else you wanted to bring up or talk about that we kind of covered on this issue?
I just wanted to say that to update you on the Ten Commandments issue.
Yeah,
we had the same thing going on here in Louisiana. Our governor got this law passed to have the Ten Commandments posted in the schools all over the state, and it was actually struck down, and it's back under appeal now.
And so here's the question. In the Louisiana Constitution, can they create that law?
That is a good question.
Because that's the question that we have to always ask. Are they creating law where they don't have the authority? It's the same thing with Congress. See, our state governments have constitutions too. And we've delegated to them the things we want them to do. And so because our state government has basically decided they can make any law that they want to, because there's nothing constraining them, because the federal government has been hoodwinking them into creating all these other laws that they don't have within the federal constitution or the state constitution, like labor laws, like housing laws, like environment, and so forth and so on. And so, you know, the states just do these things, and nobody's challenging these things. It gets old for me to be the only one, either in social media or publicly, saying, hey, look, folks, your state doesn't have the authority to do this. It is not within your state constitution. California is just running, all these state legislatures are running roughshod over their constitutions. So, until we actually start holding them accountable, they're going to continue doing this. And so it's one thing. Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The Louisiana Constitution grants the legislature general power to make laws regarding public education and operation of state-funded schools.
Okay.
And they're saying, but that power cannot override the First Amendment, which is incorporated against the states via the 14th Amendment.
Privilege and immunities, correct. Okay. So what? What? So they created a law. The governor had them create a law that did what again?
Posted the Ten Commandments in all state, all the schools all over the state.
Okay. So does that law, does it abridge the privileges and immunities of the citizens by just posting the Ten Commandments?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
And they're interpreting the Establishment Clause incorrectly.
Correct. Yes, that's right. Because it's not establishing a faith or church and not getting people to worship it, right? It's only a historical document that basically says this is the basis. As a matter of fact, when you really look at Louisiana, their history goes back to Rome, or I should say Spain, and then France and Spain, right? And the Roman Catholic Church.
Correct.
Okay. So...
And while at the same time, though, we have this whole LGBTQ whatever stuff being put into the schools and children being indoctrinated, which is just completely ridiculous. Children don't have the developmental skills to even understand what they're being taught when it comes to that issue.
Yeah, but the question is that something within that? Do they have the authority to dictate the curriculum? See, this is where we really need to look at, because if they're literally saying general powers, are the general powers granted for something specific, or are they granted generally? Because there's the difference between the two. Like, they have the ability to create laws generally regarding the operations or regarding something under a very specific, you know, topic or some very specific matter, not over everything education. Because if it was general powers over education, then it would say the state legislature has general powers over education within the state. Now,
an operation of state-funded schools, yeah, that's okay. What they have, the legislature.
Okay, so now what would have to happen for the people to take that back is either amend the state constitution or get the counties or your parishes, you have parishes there, getting the parishes to actually stand up and say, you know what, this is not working. The powers and the constitution that we have for this state is not actually meeting, because we made the mistake of allowing general powers to be granted. We need to pull all of these things back so that the counties have more control over these topics and these matters. It should not be for the state to be able to become, you know, the autocratic or the agenda driver on all things within the state. That the counties being the parties, or the parishes being the parties that created the state, then the parishes need to stand up and say, you know what, the way these things are now being applied, they no longer work. Because underneath the Declaration of Independence, if our government is doing things that we just don't agree with anymore, then we have a right to do one of two things. And actually, because we have constitutions and we have the parties who have the power over the constitution, i.e. the people and the people's government, that people's government being the parishes, then the parishes being the parties to the state compact, they have the authority to convene a convention and rewrite that state constitution and peel all that crap out. That's why counties, and in Louisiana specifically, parishes matter most. That's why that document or that article that was written last year helps everybody understand how you have to get your county movement going, and then everybody can start realizing that you do have problems with your state. Your state, because of the federal government hoodwinking them into assuming powers, you've got all sorts of problems that your state is author, you know, exercising power. So you got your constitution. Anything for the environment, you just do a word search for environment. And while you're doing a word search for that, the next word search is minimum wage. Does the state have the ability to establish via their constitution, your constitution, does the state legislature have the power to establish a minimum wage? See, these are the types of things. So now that we're talking, and we need to get back to the U.S. Constitution, but I'll give you a whole bunch of things to start scrubbing, and you're going to find that why is it that you actually have a minimum wage? Because the federal government mandated it. It's not power given to you, nor is it power given to them. It's a government assuming unconstitutionally power to get the states to assume the exact same unconstitutional power. See how the problem has been basically exponentially expanded because the culprit, the first, you know, unconstitutional assumption was done at the federal level. So anyway, let's get back to the color-coded Constitution, and let's get back to, I think we start off with the no senator, and this kind of helps everybody understand that this is really a standard, right? So go ahead.
No senator or representative shall, during the time for which he was elected, be appointed to any civil office under the authority of the United States, which shall have been created, or the emoluments whereof shall have been increased during such time. And no person holding any office under the United States shall be a member of either house during his continuance in office.
Okay, so what does that mean? Obviously, we covered the no person shall, which means that that is a standard being applied, right? But what is it that they're really saying there? So they're saying that the first thing that they're saying is you can't be appointed to a civil office under the authority of the United States, which have been created or emoluments whereof have been increased during such time. In other words, you can't be taken from your position as a senator or representative in Congress and shall during that time get appointed to some other civil office, like in the Department of Treasury, become the Secretary of the Treasury, and basically receive the emoluments or receive an increase that has occurred prior to you going in there. So in other words, this is a hard cap that says you can't be taken and put into a civil position. So what happens when somebody actually, like let's say Senator Rubio became the Secretary of the Department of State, right?
Correct.
Now, was there an increase in the Department of State when Trump became president? So that, you know, there was more money going into that he was basically being able to put Rubio into a sweet deal. In other words, it's one thing to be able to appoint him, but it's another, and removing him, but it's another thing being appointed to an office and holding such time while you're still a member of the House or what have you, right? So you can't be sitting in two places at once. And then secondly, when you move, that the only pay you can get is the pay that was authorized prior to your appointment. In other words, if it was increased prior to your appointment or after your appointment, then you can't get that increase. You can only get what the original pay was, the emoluments. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Okay. And on the part about which shall have been created, so that's like if they come up with a new department.
Yes,
can't
correct.
Can it be taken and put as the person?
That is precisely correct. So in other words, and we're ending. So folks, we'll have to take this back up. Let me see here. Yeah, we'll have to take this back up on Tuesday. So anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help because on Monday I'm going to just do one more because I think it begs the need to kind of cover the current events. I'm G.R. Mobley. Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.